we tune off the beat, south to south the beat, north where I'm from, Virginia, of course, south the beat, north the beat, south what it's like, hey yo, it is what it is, yeah, hey yo, what it is, hey yo, what it is, what it is,
hey, what's up, man?
You found me.
What's up?
Mike Walker. Let's talk about Northern Virginia music, man.
What? Yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious about what we're going to uncover.
well, listen,
you're
probably the most accomplished musician that I've ever had on the podcast. And let me just start by telling the folks that that you are truly a wizard and you know, one of the most amazing multi-instrumentalists that I've ever come across in my life, and that's why I wanted to have you on the show.
Kind words.
But why don't you introduce yourself and just tell them like who you are and where you're from?
All right. That's very kind words. You're too kind.
It's true, man.
I'm Mike Walker from Alexandria, Virginia, at least born and raised there. Currently live in San Francisco, California. Beautiful, foggy San Francisco. And, yeah, amazing to be honored with that great introduction. I don't know if I agree, but definitely thank you for those kind words.
So when did you start playing music? What's your earliest memory of playing any sort of musical instrument?
Well, you know, I grew up around two parents that were both musicians of sorts, amateurs, of course. My dad playing guitar and my mom playing piano. So it was probably piano. I mean, just jamming out, slamming keys. And probably semi-breaking my dad's guitar. And whatever else I could get my hands on. I mean, my dad was also, you know, a multi-instrumentalist. He had all these crazy instruments, like he had a zither and a koto, and he had a violin and all this interesting stuff. So, you know, going back to simpler times when we were growing up, it was like, thankfully, there was no less electronic stimulation, so you just get bored and just grab whatever's on the floor. So, you know, it's probably like a mixture of all of that stuff, just going through my dad's random instruments and trying to imitate what they were doing, probably. But, you know, I started taking piano lessons when I was 87, so 9 or 10, and maybe even before that, singing in choir. Was in church choir. So that was probably like the first exposure to actual, you know, musicianship and getting instruction from somebody else.
That's a classic story of, you know, the music from church to being a very early influence. On, you know, church being a powerful thing. Probably the best thing about it is the music. That's how I always felt about any sort of religious ceremonies.
Yeah, when you're there, whether you like it or not, you have to find something you like, right? I just saw the Whitney documentary. I don't know if you saw that, the Whitney Houston documentary.
Not yet.
Oh, my God. It's well worth seeing, in my opinion, but I mean, fascinating. She grew up around, you know, all of her family pretty much were musicians and singers. Of course, Dionne Warwick and her mother and cousins and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, also she was in the church wailing, just kicking butt in the choir. And yeah, it's what else are you going to do? If you're in church, you might as well do something. So I was there too.
I've never even really heard you sing. Can you sing at all? Like, are you able to hold the tune?
I'll have to dig something up and see if I can sing something. I used to, yeah. I mean, I was we never talked about this, but I mean, you know, I was in choir, so choir voice, like soprano, alto voice pre-puberty. It was pretty nice, and then it all fell apart probably, but I was doing solos in the church, and yeah, it was pretty good. I was okay.
Nice.
Good enough to do solos. And then I also sang later. And I still sing, yeah, sing to the kids and whatnot. So, but not enough for, I don't know. Yeah, well, I mess around.
What was your dad doing with all those instruments? Like, was he playing in any sort of, like, band kind of thing? Or
he
just collected or?
Oh yeah.
Okay.
My dad, has an interesting musical history. I mean, I have a theory that basically he was fucking up and fucking around in middle school and lower grades of high school. And so his parents sent him to boarding school, and at boarding school, his way of bonding with other friends, as far as I can tell, is through American rock music. And he was big into psychedelic rock, like, growing up, I remember, you know, he, like, it was vinyl back then, right? Pretty much. Tapes were just coming out. So he had all the psychedelic stuff, like Jimi Hendrix, Procol Harum, The Birds, weird stuff. Weirder, I guess. Not that weird. And then my mom had, like, The Beatles. And so that's what I was hearing growing up. But, yeah, he played in a rock band in high school and, you know, was show me pictures of that, and I was like, oh, that's so cool, that's really cool. And then he took when he went to college, he took classical guitar, and he was actually, I think he was a music major, but maybe like a couple credits shy. So very good classical guitarist, and that's what I grew up hearing, like Andreas Segovia and John Williams and all the like greats of classical flamenco and Spanish, and you know, taking the guitar into real classical music. So that was cool. And he would always just play, like anytime we had 5 minutes of downtime, like we wait to go out or something, he'd pick up the guitar and play. And now I have that terrible habit, which pisses everybody in my family off, pick up the guitar and play for like 5 minutes and like, come on, let's go. But you got to fit it in where you can, right? So yeah. So but he was also just, I mean, I think he was interested in world music, and so, you know, like a lot of folks in college, he just collected all sorts of stuff. I think he focused on stringed instruments. He also did violin when he was younger, and I remember he has like a three-quarters violin, and I tried to teach myself that, which was a disaster. It sounded horrible, and never really tried violin again. But that was like, yeah, earliest childhood memories. I was messing with a violin and a zither, and of course, we had a piano in the house, so I mean, that's really the centerpiece. When you have a piano in the house and your mother plays, and she played very, very well, you just want to play. Also, my grandparents or my grandmother played piano. I think I might have told you. I mean, she was excellent. She was a cellist in college, and the story is that on the day of her final recital, she fell downstairs and broke certain bones in her body and was unable to perform, and really had a long time of recovery. And while she was recovering, she started working on piano instead. And she became an excellent pianist and continued to play, you know, probably into her 70s, really, really well. So I grew up around a lot of music through that as well.
And what was the scene like in Alexandria? You know, I kind of know what things were like, you know, in Northern Virginia around Reston. You were a little bit closer to D.C. So how did growing up in Alexandria sort of influence you other than the church?
Oh, man. Well, I got to say, yeah, some funny stories. On my block, of course, I was very lucky to have a whole bunch of kids that lived on the block, and we were all, you know, more or less friends, and we were all more or less the same age group. So, like, my buddy down the street, Brian Tighe, played piano as well, and his younger sister did, and they were doing the Suzuki method, and I remember, you know, it was sort of competitive, like, who could be better at piano, and we went at it toe-to-toe for a while. But a funny story, so like our next-door neighbor was this girl named Casey, and her mother would encourage her to do plays and musicals and acting and all sorts of stuff. And so her mother and father built a stage in the backyard, and we'd get all the kids together, and we actually put on The Sound of Music. So, yeah. Singing career didn't take off for me, but I actually performed. I don't think I've told almost anybody this, but we were doing The Sound of Music, and we would go and practice with her mom, and, you know, The Hills Are Alive would sing all that nonsense. And I, you know, I've seen that movie like a million times, so I knew all the songs. But the funny part of the story was, I mean, this she was younger than me by like 2 years. I think she was like more closer to my brother's age. And she was so into acting and music, and just kind of a little maybe over into it, I guess. So, all the kids in the neighborhood were just like having fun with it. But we were all perhaps wrong, because off she went, and she ended up, I don't know her whole story, but ended up making it to Saturday Night Live. It was Casey Wilson, who was on for a few seasons. And, you know, is now an amazing comic. Check her out, Casey Wilson. But yeah, she's our next-door neighbor. And, you know, like, had this big-ass stage in her backyard that we would all perform in. So I guess kind of grew up around that. So that's like on a serious local tip, right? Like on your block.
Yeah.
But also, I think, I mean, going beyond Alexandria, and I mean, I think you and I share maybe the same feeling about this. There's just something about the people in the D.C., Maryland, and Virginia area, and the attitude towards music, and just something about independent musicians, like making their own stuff, was really, I think, just important, or just it popped up. It seemed like it was everywhere, right? Like whether it was go-go or punk rock or what have you, there was a lot of independent musicians. And I think, you know, as I got older, like into high school, I was hugely inspired by that.
Were you going out to shows in D.C.? Did you go to the old 930? Did you go to the Black Cat? Did you check out any of that stuff?
Yes, of course. I know. Like, I mean, for us, any suburbanite, it was like, all right, if you really want to see music, you go into DC and you go to the 930 Club, right? For real. I mean, we had little local spots. The Birchmere, definitely a cool spot in Alexandria for folk music and bluegrass and all that stuff. Close by. But if you were for real, you're going into DC. So of course, yeah, I went to the old 930 Club and the new 930 Club, and I mean, the old 930 Club is like epic, right? That pole in the middle of the floor. I don't know if you did you go there too?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Yes, okay. So, you know, I mean, there was like that stupid metal pole in the middle of like the front area where everybody stood in front of the stage. And they put, I guess, a video camera up there, or like a guy could work it, I think. But of course, like, you know, it was a lot of vicious punk rock music and everybody's moshing, and inevitably somebody would run into the metal pole and like hurt themselves badly. Like the stupidest design ever for the kind of music we were listening to. But yeah, I mean, like, if you know, that was the shit, going down to the original 930 Club, and gosh, I don't know what I saw first there. I'm trying to remember, but I went a ton of times, you know, to see punk rock, to see industrial music, which actually there is, yeah, a budding industrial scene, a few good bands in DC as well that I got into in like ninth grade and stuff like that. This is another crazy story. I went to the 930 Club, I think I was in ninth grade, and, you know, put on my coolest outfit and went with my most punk rock friend. I don't remember what we're seeing. It's probably like a really, there was amazing musicians there and just like really out there shit that I don't think like you really see as much anymore, in my opinion. But we're walking in to, you know, get a stamp and go into the club. And I see these two people making out like really heavy. This chick wearing a leather jacket, and they're just like going at it full time. And my buddy that's with me, who's from my high school, is like, "That's Miss Jacobson." And I was like, "What? Miss Jacobson, the music teacher? Are you serious?" And it was our fucking music teacher from our private high school. Like all punk rocked out with like her hair done up and, you know, like a leather jacket with spikes and everything. Of course, my friend was wearing a leather jacket with spikes, and we're like, "Miss Jacobson." And she's like, "Oh," all like caught off guard. And, you know, there we were all together for the love of music, I guess.
Well, speaking of local music and like your high school, what was actually going on there? What were you, like, who were the big bands, you know, coming out of your high school, or people that were like the, you know, the major musicians at that time around you?
Yeah. I mean, I was always so frustrated. I mean, who isn't like frustrated in high school growing up? But from my perspective, I was so, you know, you look back and you're like, "Oh my God, I was so lucky to go to this great school, great teachers and all this stuff, nurturing environment." I mean, in retrospect, it was great. But at the time, I was really pissed because I, you know, associated with artists and musicians and wanted to be creative, but there weren't many outlets in high school that really supported that. Like, they had no real music program to speak of. I mean, I was taking piano lessons, you know, by the time I was in high school for many years, and kind of had to like hide in the corner to get a piano lesson from a teacher. It was almost like secret. So, but like, you know, the people that were into music really like bonded. I think that almost like that, the lack of outlets like brought people together, which is a good thing. And yeah, so there were a few bands. I mean, we did like Battle of the Bands, and I was in a few bands, and I would say like high school bands, there was a great bunch of musicians who rotated through a number of bands. Matt Warschauer and Rudy Lopez and some guys like that I would sometimes play with. Like, we would cover Rage Against the Machine. I remember we did that at, I think it was like at Battle of the Bands or something like that. I speaking of vocals, believe it or not, I did the vocals to Bomb Track, so what? Yeah, little known fact. That was interesting.
Well,
but Matt,
we all need to rap, man.
You know,
I mean,
you know,
it's not that surprising.
That was my foray into public rapping, I guess, like getting out there. But yeah, we did. Like, I was in a band. We did cover songs. We covered Reverend Horton Heat. I think we did win the Battle of the Bands that year. I don't know why, because actually Matt's band was hella better. And they went on to form a band called Infectious Organisms, which was relatively successful in the local scene. And, you know, I think they became a college band. You know, some of them were in Richmond, and they played in D.C. and Virginia. And it was like a good mix of hip-hop and rock, like a good mix, because there's a lot of bands that are not a good mix of that, but they knew what was up. 40
days and 40 nights, she had control of me. You hear poetry, whisper slowly, here's what she told me. Listen closely, you know you owe me. For 40 days and 40 nights, she had control of me. Pure poetry. whisper slowly, here's what she told me. Listen closely, you know you owe me. Now we can only have one king, and there's only one crown to fit him. The rest are just victims, either dead or in prison. A madman's system blurs the visions of a better day. So little Bobby sells poison in the hallway, supply and demand. Boy becomes a man, 45 in his hand, concrete, Vietnam. Small piece in the plan for the future. Delilah had a hold of your heart, and everybody plays a part. Plays a part. 40 nights, she had control of me, pure poetry. Whisper slowly, here's what she told me. Listen closely, you know you owe me. For 40 days and 40 nights, she had control of me, pure poetry. Whisper slowly, here's what she told me. Listen closely, you know you owe me.
6 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, it's barely morning. Fatigue body, stretch out the bed, she's barely yawning. Barely old enough to be a woman. Child inside a womb, barely alive to see the ocean of life's surroundings. The night's astounding. Eyes still evading stories of faith, fights to receive. Regrets like the depths of a bean. She turned towards the nicotine-filled ashtray with instructions on escaping the madness. Far from perfect in this game of life's mastering. Afraid of being alone with a child. Thinking, could a God provide a better home in the sky? Together we die, ominous, why?
40 days and 40 nights, she had control of me, pure poetry.
And then Matt went on to do, he was a professional musician for many years and played with a band that got signed to a major label, RCA or J Records, I think. And off he goes. So, I mean, those guys were very talented musicians and I was lucky to play with them. But Matt and his older brother Dave were really close friends of mine since basically birth. Actually, their father he delivered me from birth. He was my mother's obstetrician. So we really literally like knew each other from birth. And so I would go over to their house and Matt played bass, Dave played drums, I played guitar, and I would do vocals. And we would just, you know, do cover songs. And we were into like Red Hot Chili Peppers, Rage Against the Machine, that kind of stuff. And then we would make our own originals. And that's where I learned to, you know, jam in a rock band, basically.
What was the band called?
Oh, shit. I don't even know. I don't think we had a name. I think we, like, almost purposefully did not want a name. we might have even made up, like, stupid names from time to time just to mess with people. But,
how do you win a battle of the bands without a name?
Oh my God. I know. Actually, you were exactly right. I remember distinctly being in, you know, so we do like battle of the bands and I don't know if it's on a weekend or like a Friday night or a Monday night, you know, it's not like a normal school day. It was an evening and I was trying to impress a girl at the time who ended up becoming my wife, strange enough. But I remember we did two songs. We did Reverend Horton Heat, $400, and we did some Smashing Pumpkins song. I don't remember which one it was. And we used, like, that one was probably the reason why perhaps we won. We used, like, vibraphone and all these, like, interesting instruments that we borrowed from the shitty band area from our high school. And, the next day we show up and it's like, you know, we're going to announce the winner of Battle of the Bands. And it is Mike Walker and his band. No name. And I was like, what the fuck? We won? Like, it was crazy. Everyone kind of couldn't, I don't know. Cause we went out there and I remember I just screamed at the top of my lungs. Like it was just, you know, you're angsty as a teenager. Right. So, the $400 song, we're just like going all out screaming and just fucking thrashing and being like, yeah, we can do this in high school.
I sent you $400 so you could buy some car. I love you so much, I didn't get too far.
There was also like a death metal band. So it was like good variety. I mean, there was a lot of great musicians. That's the thing. Like, I guess bringing it back to growing up in Northern Virginia, there was no shortage of great musicians everywhere. And I just felt like people were always just messing around with music.
So when did hip hop come into it? Like when did you start rapping? When did you start freestyling? when did you get turntables?
Oh damn, that is good. I distinctly remember that. So I had like a Panasonic, you know, back in the day you would buy that like kind of like rack in a box, because back in the day everybody had like a tape player, a turntable, and if you're lucky you might have had a CD player with, you know, an amplifier that's integrated into the whole system, and they would, you know, they would sound like shit basically, but they relatively inexpensive. And I actually think if you ever watch Seinfeld, the little known fact, the integrated stereo system that Seinfeld has on, you know, in his living room on the shelf there is the same one that I had, but it had a record player on top. And I distinctly remember my friend Chip and I were watching MTV and we saw LL Cool J and just thought he was like just absurd. We were like, how is this guy for real? Like, he's got gold chains and he's like 19 years old and he's like so audacious and just bold and, you know, cracking up. And so I went to Sam Goody the next day and I bought an LL Cool J record, and it was what was the A side was I'm That Type of Guy, and the B side was It Gets No Rougher. And little did I know that, and, you know, only much, much later did I realize how good that single was. And really, it was the B side, It Gets No Rougher, that was a battle song. That was an LL Cool J like battle rap. It was a one-on-one, like, I'm gonna take you out kind of rhyme. And anyway, I put that record on my turntable, and of course, like every curious kid, tried to scratch, and I held onto the record and let it play. And, you know, that's the other thing, like, when you have this cheap equipment that's your own as a kid, you don't hold back, you just mess around and experiment and whatever. I had a little tape recorder and I would record stuff. And just learned to do very basic baby scratching. You know, I didn't have a fader, of course. I just had like a volume knob, so I kind of messed with that. And I had never seen any like real DJ do anything, but just messed around and made music, like simple rhythm and stuff with that. So that's the first time I ever scratched.
What were you in? You were in like fourth grade?
No, that was probably middle school. It was probably like sixth or seventh grade. Like Nintendo 8-bit era.
Nice. So when did you upgrade to actually getting a mixer and a decent turntable?
Oh, well, I mean, much, much later. So, I mean, I that was like just messing around. And to go back to one of your other questions, I mean, then I just got exposed to more and more hip hop. You know, in high school, I started to hear stuff like, or middle school, I guess, started to hear N.W.A. And I was like, whoa, that's real. And then, you know, Dre came out and West Coast rap. And I was like, all right, this is what's up. And I got really into the West Coast stuff. Because I guess that was just what you heard on the radio a lot too. And, also Go-Go, but we can get back to that later. Anyhow, yeah, when I got, I didn't get a turntable until much, much later. I mean, what? It was college really, right? I mean, it was from your turntables and mixer that I got to be able to actually scratch and have two turntables and a mixer where I could actually try to mix records. And I believe it was your turntables that I borrowed in that Gemini Insane mixer that like I would literally scratch until my hands bled I don't know, it probably happened to you too. Like, you can't scratch on that mixer. They had screws on either end of the crossfader. So if you're really going at it, trying to transform and like dig your, you know, move fast, like inevitably you're going to mess up your fingers. And yeah, so it was in college that I started messing around with that. And I didn't even get my first turntable until after that. I mean, it was expensive, right? Like a real turntable, like a 1200, which in my opinion was at the time, like, you know, it was 1200 or nothing if you wanted to try to scratch. So yeah, until then it was a curiosity, and I was like just trying to learn through other people's equipment like yours, or well, I guess teaching on the radio and stuff like that in college radio.
Who was rapping at your school
in high school?
Was anybody rapping there? Was anybody like trying to do it?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, people would be shocked because, you know, I went to a private high school. It was Episcopalian. But we had a few kids that would. So the thing was, like, I would go to school early. I would take the bus into school. And there are only a few people that took the bus into school. It's the people whose parents are not driving them to school daily. And that's a certain group of people, basically. And so I get to ride in with the bus, and we listen to, you know, the hip-hop channel on the radio in the morning, which is usually be Go-Go, which is totally awesome.
PGC?
And, PGC or KYS, of course. I remember, I mean, damn, they played Northeast Groovers like crazy. Actually, Northeast Groovers
were
at high school for one of the events, I don't remember, which is amazing. Amazing.
That's the shit.
I wish somebody videotaped it because, I mean, a mostly white high school and you've got these guys like, doing go-go. It was so nuts. It was great. But yeah, we would, you know, come into school early, because if you take the bus into school, you know, they're going to make sure you get there more than on time. And what are you going to do? We basically just sat on a bench and tried not to get in trouble. And some of the kids would freestyle rap. They would, like, one dude, I mean, it was these two guys, Ronnie and Osi, and they one of them would drum on a trash can, and the other one would bust rhymes. And so that was high school rapping right there. And then, of course, a few other folks would, like, try to break in. And, you know, it was just silliness. It was just messing around, like, nothing better to do.
Would you spit rhymes with them?
No. No, I would laugh and observe and poke fun, but I would not spit rhymes at that point. I was not... I didn't have the courage, I'll just say.
So you and your friends had like a little posse, like back then, like a little rhyming posse and whatnot. Did you guys?
Yeah, you're
like,
right.
I mean, did you guys ever try to, I don't know, like make your own songs or anything like that, or actually like? I don't know, put like some sort of beat together and then go over it yourself.
Yeah, of course. I'm totally forgetting. Of course, like in later high school, like 10th, 11th, 12th grade, yeah, we started making beats because we, you know, started getting into more interesting hip hop music and realizing the art and craft of hip hop and realizing that, hey, anybody can do this. Like, we can make beats. I mean, we were thinking like, damn, we're going to, you know, we can make a beat. We could be a producer and just make millions and just get the next hit. And it really was like that. I mean, anybody could. So, I mean, it was mostly fucking around. Like, actually, what was it? Like, my friend Pat had a computer and we figured out how to sample songs and, you know, Goldmine. From that point, right, you could sample anything, like a voice, or, you know, we would sample like Hitting on Pots and Pans, And then we would cut it up, and with, you know, our rudimentary music knowledge, we could make rhythms and beats and make it sound pretty good. And overlay, you know, I'd pull from different musical genres, classical or jazz or anything that I've heard, and make some really interesting rhythms. And then from that point, it was just full clowning about. Like, we would just, you know, make ridiculous rhymes. So Pat and Chip and Dave, the drummer I mentioned, like, we would all also rhyme and just freestyle in the car once we finally got cars. It was a ton of fun.
What program was he using on his computer to sample back then?
Dude, Cool Edit 95. What a very specific question. Yeah, fuck yeah. I think it was even one before Cool Edit 95. It was like Cool Edit 94, which became Cool Edit, which became eventually Adobe Edition. I mean, Adobe bought them, and it's an excellent suite.
You used to love Cool Edit. Like, that used to be your shit in college. Like, you would ride for Cool Edit.
Adobe Audition is running on my computer right now. I still love it. Because, yeah, you get, like, total control of the waveform visually. You know what you're doing. You can, you know, really cut it up and make anything. And, yeah, we would just make creative beats and then just get so much pleasure from that. But, you know, another thing, I don't know if I ever mentioned this in the past, but a whole other really interesting genre of music that people don't dig into because it's kind of nerdy is, I guess I call it the tracker movement. Nowadays, people might call it chiptune, but basically using these software sequencers. So not like a sequencer that's, you know, a hardware device that you buy, but just a piece of software you install on your computer to arrange samples very mechanically, like almost programming. It's almost like writing code. But all this great music was made, and it's very efficient. It doesn't take up a lot of space on the computer. And certain things you can get very creative with. So we would also mess around with that and make, like, dance and techno kind of sounding shit. And to this day, people still make music that way. And it's limiting. It's very hard. But also, you learn to make music in, a really cool, creative way. Like, I think we hear it more and more often in, electronic dance music now. Actually, the influence from that, like Deadmau5 is somebody who actually pulls a lot from the old tracker days. We'll be right back.
So when you went off to Emory, like how did college basically like change you musically, or how did it sort of affect you?
I don't know, for the better or for the worse, you can tell me. I mean, overall, I was really fortunate to be introduced to many more musicians and have access to be able to learn about different styles of music, both Eastern and Western, ancient and modern. I mean, of course, like college is just like a gold mine for the arts if you know where to look. So, you know, it started in right from square one. I feel like, I don't know, the first day I met this guy, John Maynard, who you know as well, who was like just this crazy, energetic person. He's like, you got to hear, you know, Herbie Hancock, and you got to hear this and that. And then he introduced me to you. And, you know, mind blown. We're talking about just funkadelic and crazy, crazy deep tracks of random musicians. And, you know, one thing leads to another. And you just got exposed to, I guess, all the other people that were doing that same kind of research and looking into wild music in high school. Like, we all got together and kind of shared what we found. That's what I felt. And it was like an awesome experience to just meet other people who are just genuinely curious about like finding new sounds. So it was very easy to, you know, just, it was like almost an unlimited wealth of stuff. I mean, we experienced the same thing, I think. Awesome. And then, you know, I was also fortunate enough to take advantage of real classes that were offered. So, you know, doing electronic music and jazz and gamelan, stuff like that. Like, I got to experience really, really cool different types of music I never thought I'd learn.
Yeah, you also got to play that sweet organ.
Yes. Yeah, in high school, I got a musical scholarship for pipe organ. It was this really cool program from the American Guild of Organists where they take piano players that have some skills, and they you basically audition and you get a sponsorship. You get paired up one-on-one with a professional pipe organist, and you get to take some lessons with them. And I think it was my piano teacher at the time, who encouraged me to apply for it, and, you know, I was lucky enough to get it. So in high school, I took a year, or I think it was 1 year, of pipe organ lessons and a big recital and an amazing cathedral in D.C., and I was still, you know, very interested in college. So lucky enough, actually, I was really, really passionate about pipe organ music. I almost like made my college decision based on like where the best pipe organ program was, because I was like really into it. But at Emory, there was an amazing pipe organist, Timothy Albrecht, and I applied to get lessons from him. And I remember, yeah, it's pretty funny. Like, I don't know, you've probably been through this too. Like, the first day you're with a new music teacher, it's really awkward, right? You're like, okay, yeah, let's hear, you know, play something for me. And you're like, yeah, I don't really know you. I feel comfortable. Like, what? Well, you know, going crazy here. But okay. Like, and you don't know what to pick. Like, should I pick the most ambitious, difficult song that I know? Should I pick like something really easy that I can just master? And I think I went with ambitious, and it was probably pretty sloppy. And, you know, I guess no surprise, Albrecht, who's German, likes perfection and cleanliness. He's like, all right, so, okay, that's where you're at. Like, now we're going to take it like 3 steps backwards to something much, much more simple, and you're going to work on that until it is perfect. And, but the crazy thing was, told me, he was like, you know what, I don't take undergraduates as students. I only do grad students because I'm really only interested in teaching people that want this as a profession. So why do you want to play pipe organ? And I was like, oh shit, like, here's, you know, this is a make or break moment. But I I told them the truth. It's like, I like the music and it makes me feel good. And it's almost like a meditative state when I'm playing it, because your hands are doing stuff, your feet are doing stuff. You're like doing so many things that you can't concentrate on any one thing. It's just kind of cool. And it's unique. I don't think that there's any other instrument like it. And he was like, all right, you'll be my student. And so he took me on, and I took 3 years of pipe organ with him, which is amazing.
You also played some of the clubs in Atlanta as one of the absent-minded professors. You got to actually, like, play the mid-90s club scene in Atlanta.
Yes.
How was that experience?
Oh, my God, amazing. You know what's up. Unreal. That was so much fun for a variety of reasons. It was silly. But, yeah, I mean, you know, I did the college radio with my buddy Tim, our buddy Tim, and met a few other college radio musicians, Ben and Mark, and we kind of just formed this unholy alliance, different musical genres. You know, I was doing hip-hop and jungle. What a stupid idea, by the way, all DJs out there. Never, ever try to start your DJ career by learning how to mix drum and bass or jungle music on the radio live. That's a terrible idea. Really hard. And you will fuck up. Although, it will create some pressure. So maybe pressure makes diamonds. Yeah. Like, I was, you know, hip-hop was my thing, but then jungle and drums and bass, I think I enjoyed, and also it mixed better with the rest of the fellas' music, because they were playing French house and hard techno and other stuff. And so we kind of created that crew. And I got to give credit to Tim. He was very entrepreneurial, extremely, and just thought, like, hey, we can, you know, make money doing this, and we can make mixtapes, and we can, you know, get some club gigs, and we're going to rake in the dough. And of course, college kid, we're poor as hell, don't have any money. I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Like, anything. I'd rather do that than a work study job. So let's get it on. And we would make flyers and, you know, go out to these, we'd just bold as hell. Like, we'd go to these places and, you know, zero experience. We're like, yeah, we want to do a gig. And they're like, okay, you can show up. Like, on a Wednesday night, we'll see who shows up. And, you know, of course, through the power of college and networking, we were very fortunate that, you know, one person would tell another person and spread the word. You got to go down to, you know, so-and-so club. And these clubs were like, I mean, you remember, they were like strip clubs on a Friday night. They were not necessarily clubs you're going to like tell college girls to go to, for instance. But on, you know, we would party every night of the week. So it was a trip. And yeah, it was really fun. Like, we had incredibly nicely packed venues. And that's when I really learned to rock the crowd. I mean, you know, as a DJ, your number one job is to keep people dancing and make them happy, not play the music you want or shout and scream, but, you know, you're there to keep the beat going. So that's where I learned all of that.
And during the summertime, you got to come back to Northern Virginia, and you came and visited me and Reston. I guess it was during the summer and the winter time. And you started playing with some of my friends back in Reston. So you started jamming with Kevin Whiteley and Dennis Hoy a little bit.
Yeah.
In the DKB. So what do you remember from those jams, and what were your impressions of Reston music?
That's a loaded question. What do you remember? I know I did it, but what do I remember? Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, that was so much fun. I remember falling asleep listening to Maggot Brain. You put the, I think you had it on vinyl or tape or something, and you're like, listen to this. It's going to blow your mind after a long night of jamming. But, dude, that was so fun. I had the Korg. So this is another story that I probably shouldn't tell. But in high school, like I said, I was kind of bitter. There was no music scene at the school. Like, they didn't really have an outlet for art. But I went in, you know, their, like, closets, and I found the Korg. I mean, like, the original monophonic, you know, I don't know, 2.5-octave Korg keyboard that's now iconic and has been reproduced in software, and they've also rebuilt the hardware. Anyway, basically, I walked out with a keyboard from high school because no one was using it. It was collecting dust, and I felt I would give it a better home. And I still have it to this day, so hopefully no one's
listening. You put it to good use, bro.
I sure did, because it needed some use. I mean, they probably literally bought it in, like, 1976 and put it on a shelf. So, damn it, I'm going to show this thing some love. So, yeah, I would bring that, right? I would bring the Korg and a guitar, and Dennis was there, Kevin was there, you were there. I think we had, like, a bunch of other folks as well. I mean, multiple jam sessions. And it was truly free form. But, you know, so it would, I don't know, like somebody would take the lead. Like Dennis would drop a beat. And then we'd be like, okay, let me put a little keyboard to this. Let me try a little Korg. Let's throw a little guitar on it. But, you know, everybody had such chops. And we listened to each other and, you know, looked at each other. And it was fucking awesome. It was really, really fun. I mean, God, we played hours and hours nonstop, right? I mean, it would just be like until the point of exhaustion, we'd just keep playing. So, yeah, those were probably some of the best jam sessions I've ever been in. We'll be right back.
some of the best jam sessions I've ever seen. I mean, you guys are three of the best, like, I've ever seen on your instruments, and three people that, like, understand music in really interesting ways and have interesting relationships to music and sound, and each, like, really brought something to it.
Well, yeah, that is kind. We were all learning. I mean, I didn't know how to jam like that. Like, you know, I showed up, no prior experience, really. Like, you know, my prior band experience, like, we would pick a song and be like, all right, here's the riff. Like, you do this, you do that. It was a lot of, like, talking and less jamming. This, like, we didn't talk. We did not, like, I don't think we said a word. We would just, like, sit down, beat plays. Somebody's speaking through music, through their instrument, and off we go. And then we'd go for like 4 hours. It was like, okay, this is real jamming. So, and I was figuring it out as I go along. And honestly, like, keyboard, you know, I was a classically trained pianist. I never learned improv until much later when I did some jazz stuff. So I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I was like, all right, let's, you know, melodic minor. I think I could, like, play over this and figure something out, and okay, now we're going to this chord. And it was like rough, but we quickly adapted because we all had kind of like the common beat in mind. Like, we had like a theme and communicated with each other in other ways. So yeah, it was totally fun. I learned a ton.
And you played the Rhodes over at the Moore household too, didn't you? Didn't you get to jam with them on the Rhodes also?
Amazing. Yes. I totally did not know how awesome that was. Now I'm like desperate to own a Rhodes, to be honest. I would love one. Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea how cool that was at the time. And now, like, that is one of my favorite classic sounds, and just a beautiful, unique instrument. So I did.
All right, so I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about DJ Mike Bree and the battling, mm-hmm. and, you know, the DMC. So after college, you got very heavy into DJ battling.
Yeah.
And I got a chance to see you live on a few occasions. And you
yes.
just fucked people up. they were not expecting what you were bringing. So how did you break into that scene? And, you know, how did it take you all the way to the heights of the DMCs?
Yeah.
The Disco Mix Championship.
Yeah. Well, damn. I mean, all of what we're talking about, kind of culmination of that, of course, getting me excited about music and competition. And then it was probably watching the, so I was over at some friend's house, Brandon and Chip's place. They were at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. And I think at the time, shit, we were still in Emory, and I was back, and it was like, somehow it was summer, but they were still there, and I would go over there, and we were watching a video of this DJ battle, and it was a team competition, and it was a group called the Invisible Scratch Pickles versus a group called the X-Men, and the Scratch Pickles were from the West Coast, from the Bay Area, San Francisco, in Daly City, and the X-Men were from New York, from the Bronx, and from Queens, and Brooklyn, and I was blown away. I was like, this is unreal. Like, I did not know you could do that with turntables. You know, I knew you could scratch, but I didn't know you could make an entire song from scratching where everyone plays an instrument. I didn't know that you could do body tricks in unison with an entire team, and like, they were both just incredible styles. It blew my mind. And it blew my friends' minds as well, Brandon and Chips. So they all dedicated to go get turntables, and they had means to get that and started assembling a collection. And I would go back and visit them during school, and you know, we would mostly freestyle rap and just play instrumentals and drink 40s and whatnot, do what we did, and stay up till late at night. But we started to learn to scratch and started to learn to mix, because, you know, just like true DJing, like, you know, you're freestyle rapping, like, you want the beat to go on, so you learn how to blend from one beat to the next. And you know, this is like Ruckus Records was coming out with all these amazing instrumentals, and all of their records had both the vocal, the instrumental, and the acapella. So it was very easy to mix different songs. You could take an acapella from one record, put it on an instrumental of another, and it was all this like nice underground backpacker style hip hop. So anyway, that's how I started getting my hands on real mixers. They started buying the Vestax, Mixstick, and the O5 Pro. And I realized, okay, like, what's up is short throw crossfaders. That allows you to do scratching that couldn't be done with like the old Geminis and whatnot. The mixers are old. So I started there, and it wasn't until after college when I moved to Charlottesville that I was able to buy my first turntable, and that's when I really actually started to hook from scratch.
And keep going.
Well, I'll tell you another funny story. I was desperate to buy turntables, but I didn't have enough money to buy two. So my buddy Brandon had two mixers and he gave me one, which I'm eternally thankful for. He gave me the Vestax O5 Pro, which is an amazing mixer. And so RIP Vestax, they don't make their stuff anymore. That's too bad. Same with Shure M4047s. Anyway, so I was like trying to get a deal on a turntable because every penny counts. And I'm looking on, you know, this is like prior to Craigslist, and just like scouring the classifieds in Charlottesville. And there's not a lot of DJs there, but this one dude listed turntables for sale, and it was like a pretty good deal. I don't know. It's like, I think it was like $250 for a Technics 1200 that happened to be like made in Europe, had the wrong voltage and all this shit. And I'm like, yes, I'm buying it. I call him up. He's like, yeah, I still got it for sale. I'm like, all right, I'm coming to your house right now. And he lives on the top of the mountain. I forget what it's called, but like a really weird location. I go up there and he's like, yo, I'm not going to DJ anymore. Like, I bought the turntable, I bought these records, you know, I like hip hop, but like, I'm not going to do it. So do you want these records as well? And he gave me a few records. I'm like, yeah, I'll take them. He's like, all right, here you go. And he's like, you go knock yourself out, man. You become the next Qbert. He told me, I'm like, oh yeah, I will. I looked him in the eye. I was like, I'm going to do that shit. You know what? He was like, you know, he didn't think I had it. So I was like, I'll show you, man. I'm going to do this. I never saw him again. But that motivated me. I was like, fuck it. I'm gonna learn to scratch. So for the longest time, I only had one turntable. I could not really mix. I had like, you know, I'd plug a Walkman into one side of my mixer, and I had it set up in my kitchen. So I would like just turn around whatever I was doing in my kitchen. I'd put a beat on, and I'd start scratching. And I would learn to scratch with a baby scratch, you know, start from the basics. And I would learn just straight from sounds and by watching a couple of videos from Scratch Pickles. This is before they had like instructionals and all that stuff. So it's kind of like just figuring it out, but learning simple stuff like the chirp scratch, and then going back to Richmond to my buddies, and they ended up building a whole setup. They had the ability to have three people on the turntables and three different mixers at the same time. So like, they were blowing my mind. I would go there and, you know, Chip would be scratching out just a beat with a kick and a snare. Brandon would be scratching out like a melody with a vocal line. And, you know, I could get on and just make some random scratches with ah or fresh or something. And together we were making music and we were like, whoa, this is like jam bands, but with turntables. Like, this is something different. So that's how I started getting really into it, and we formed a crew. We called it Cobra Kai. And we all had our DJ names and started working on like a repertoire where we could do, you know, solo stuff and team stuff. And actually all of the original DJing I did with them was team things where we would make music together and do like three turntables or four turntables and, you know, do quick mixes to try to play like, you know, dope hip hop tracks, like underground tracks and stuff that we liked, but keep it moving really fast, like only one verse or even less than a verse because, you know, crowd, they lose their attention fast and then mix it up with, you know, really team DJing, like real composition, real turntablism. So that's, before I started battling, like that's how I started learning to scratch and perform with turntables.
And then?
And then the battles. Yeah. Gosh, the battles, I mean, talk all day about, but I guess the first battle I went to was at Mary Washington College. And I have no idea how I found out about it. I think Brandon said, like, there's a battle. And I'm like, we should go. We should do this. Like, fuck it. Let's just get out there and do our stuff. And I had no idea what I was going to do or what I was up against. I know what it was. I don't think I performed that time. Yeah, we went and just we watched. And what we got to witness, like, we were very lucky, very fortunate, because at that battle were two rival battle crews from Northern Virginia that ended up really accelerating to great heights. One of them was the Goonies crew, and they had Rocktacon and Icon and S-Hands. And then the other one was the Troopers crew, and they had Inferno, Geometrics, and Quicks. And the six of those guys all battled against each other, and they were like vicious rivals. And there was also DJ Fiend and a couple of other really dope DJs that were independent, basically. And it was a great battle. Like, they were, I mean, I was like, wow, okay. Like, this is, you know, a Hispanic guy and a white guy and a black guy and a Filipino guy. And we're all getting together and just for the love of music and DJing, like, competing against each other. This is something special. And I remember sitting in the car with Brandon afterwards, and I was like, dude, I want to do this. Next time I'm entering, like, I want to fucking run this game. And he was like, all right, let's do this. And sure enough, like, after that, we started practicing our battle stuff. And I started making routines with anything. Like, I was just starting to watch, you know, videos. We started to watch the DMC videos and looking up to guys like Qbert and DJ Craze was just coming out. Watching those kind of videos and trying to understand the patterns behind the beat juggles. They're so complex. So I started to make routines. Entered my first and second and third DJ battles and, you know, took the lumps that you're going to take when you start out learning that performing at home is not the same as performing in front of a crowd and figuring out how you can pull off that same kind of mystique in front of an audience. But, you know, my performance experience from piano and choir and rock and everything really helped just kind of center what I was trying to do and enjoy myself on stage. And then after that, after a while, I started winning competitions, or, you know, placing and then winning. And I guess, like, the biggest surprise to me, like, I went really quickly to the DMCs. And that's, like, DMCs are, you know, especially at the time, that's the premier, biggest competition in the world. You know, it goes all the way up worldwide. It's like the Olympics of scratching, basically. And I entered the DC DMCs, and I knew the Goonies would be there. I knew that the Troopers would be there, and I knew people come down from New York to try to win it, think that they could steal this stuff from DC people, which sometimes they did, honestly. And I knew I was like a nobody. I'd never entered before, and I got second place. And I was like, whoa, this is real. Like, if I can get second place the first time I entered in DMC, like, I've actually got something. I can compete with these guys. And that taught me, like, I think I can, you know, eventually win this if I put my mind to it. So from there, you know, I, for about 5 years straight, I just battled like crazy, and ended up winning regional DMCs, going to the nationals, went to the national finals in LA.
He goes by the name of Mike
what?
Green, and he represents the NBA All-Stars crew. Give it up, y'all, for Mike Green.
Chicago in 2006, and, you know, things went my way and won the national finals and got to go to the World Championships in London and got fourth place there against an amazing, amazing crew of people. So that was like a real musical highlight for me.
What was the routine that you won with?
Well, you may have one of the few custom-made vinyl records that contains the actual tracks of that routine. And this was right when Serato came out, so it was, you were not allowed to use digital vinyl in competition. It had to be all records and all that good stuff. So what I thought would be, you know, I wanted to do something different than everybody else. Otherwise, you're never going to win. You have to stand out and have something special. And so I started using computer skills with Cool Edit and whatnot, and my sampling, because I had tons of samples all the way going back to high school, and started building my own beats, started building my own songs, started sampling things, manipulating the sounds. But what I did was I would prototype it using Serato, which is digital vinyl, so that I could test out my record before I pressed it, and I pressed a custom record. And I mean, it was a mix of, at the time I was listening to like Southern, you know, pre-trap, gangster rap, like 3-6 Mafia. I had, what else did I have? I mean, I would pull eclectic stuff. I had beats from the Beastie Boys. I had guitar riffs from Megadeth. I think it was Symphony of Destruction. I would pull guitar samples from instructional guitar videos that no one's ever heard of, and DVDs of like diss competitions to get like a good diss sample that I could use against somebody. Or I sampled the drum lines of, you know, colleges, historically black colleges from Georgia, and just tried to make like creative music from that. And, you know, first time I sampled it, it didn't work, but through this effort of like testing it out on Serato and tweaking it a little bit on my computer, testing out it again, going back and forth really quickly, eventually I arrived at something that really was unique, and I could do stuff that I would never be able to do by just buying vinyl off the shelf. And so I said, this is what I want. I've got my routine. I sent it off to RTI Records, because RTI Records is what DJ Qbert used. And I was like, if it's good enough for Qbert, I'm going to talk to RTI. And I went in with my buddy, DJ ID, who we were in a group crew at the time, BA All-Stars, with a couple of other amazing Virginia-based DJs. DJ Marcus, who was in Hampton, so he's from Connecticut, but Hampton, Virginia. And DJ Geometrics, who was also from Northern Virginia. And anyway, ID and I pressed that vinyl through RTI. Amazing experience to actually, for the first time in your life, get a record back, like a freshly pressed record from a master that you had made. And, you know, get like 25 copies of that. It was just thrilling. Put that thing on the turntable and be like, oh my God, this is exactly what I've been messing around with, trying to tweak and perfect for the last 6 months. Here it is. And I took that record to the DMCs. And actually, the first time I lost. In 2005, I took it to the Boston DMCs. And I remember I was listening to like Eminem in my headphones, trying to get all pumped up. Like, I'm going to beat these dudes. I got the best routine. Fuck these guys. And I did have the best routine, in my opinion. I will still claim. But it wasn't my day. You know, sometimes other people have their day. Home crowd advantage will also hurt you sometimes. You're not from Boston. And I got beat, and I was really disappointed. I didn't even get second place. I think I got third place. And I was like, damn, I thought this was the best routine I've ever made, and a long shot victory, and I didn't win. And I almost gave up. And then when 2006 rolled around, I was like, I got to just do this one more time to see if I've got it. And I took it to the regionals and I won that. And then that's what took me to Chicago to victory.
So when you got out to the Bay, how were you able to get a chance to scratch with the guy that you originally saw on that video, like all those years before? How did you get a chance to scratch with the best?
Yes. Man, oh yeah, crazy story there. So I had not yet moved to San Francisco, and I was working in SF, so I would fly out from DC to San Francisco on a weekly basis for work. And very passionate about DJing, so I'd always be on the lookout for, like, you know, record stores and whatnot. Anyway, I was in the hotel that I was staying in, and I was about to check out, and this kid had a turntable strapped to his back. And that's unusual. And I was in the elevator with him, and I was like, that's a QFO from DJ Qbert, isn't it? And he's like, yeah, it is. How'd you know? And I'm like, yeah, I'm a DJ. And I was, of course, wearing like my work gear with, you know, collared shirt and whatnot, white dude. Like, all right, you're a DJ, huh? I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh, I'm Qbert's cousin. And, you know, I got his QFO. And the QFO, like, nobody had that. It was, like, super rare. I'm like, that's incredible. And he's like, you want to meet him? And I said, yeah, of course I want to meet him. And he's like, all right, like, give me your number. I'll call you up. And I'm like, well, I'm literally like getting my bags to fly out right now to go back to DC, but I'll be back on Monday. And he's like, all right, call me up, man. This is all like in an elevator conversation. Then I got back the next week. I called him up. He's like, oh yeah, Q's out of town. And this would go on for like weeks and weeks. I was going every week and Q was never there. And I was about to give up. Like, I would bring my records out. Q wasn't there. I'd go back home. Same thing. About to give up. And the kid calls me up one day, like on a Thursday night before I had to, you know, I was flying out on Friday morning. And he's like, hey, you want to meet Q? And I'm like, yes, I do. And it's been like months. And he's like, all right, he's here. I want to hook you up. I'm going to bring you over. And at this point, I'm like, this kid is full of it. I'm going to get robbed or something. But I get my records. I remember he came and picked me up at the Hilton San Francisco on Mason and Market or Mission or whatever. And he picked me up. I'm like, all right, are you for real? And he's like, yes, we're going out to Q's new place in Burlingame. And I thought, this guy's surely full of shit. And he's like, but we got to pick up Subway sandwiches. And I'm like, are you serious? He's like, yeah, Q wants some Subway. So, you know, so I realized that this kid is like basically the errand boy. And I'm like, all right, you know, I hope this is real. And he's like, I swear it's real. I'm going to call him up. I'll show you. So we go to Q-Bert, or so we go to Subway, and we get some subs. We get an extra one for supposedly Q-Bert and supposedly his girlfriend. And then he gets on the phone, and he's like, hey, you can listen. You can hear his voice. And like, I'm like, hello? And he's like, hey, man. And I hear what sounds like Q-Bert. I'm like, okay, that could be him. And he's like, hey, come on over. So we go over. And the kid's like, you should surprise him. You should be, you know, tell him you're like a Subway delivery boy. I'm like, okay, whatever. I go up to this house. It's like a nice house in a suburban neighborhood of San Francisco. Knock on the door. And lo and behold, door opens up and it's Q-Bert right there. And I'm like kind of in awe. And then I'm like following the character. I'm like, hey, I got your subs. I'm the delivery guy. $25, please. And he's like, what? Oh, okay. And he reaches into his wallet, and then the cousin jumps out of the bush. He's like, ah, we got you. And sure enough, they were buddies, cousins, whatever. And we all go inside. So we sit down, you know, we're like literally eating Subway sandwiches with Q and his girlfriend, who was like a model or something. And, you know, they're getting ready to watch a movie, him and his girl, and they're going to watch Saturday Night Live or something. I think it was Saturday Night Live. And we start talking, and, you know, he's like, oh, he wasn't like, how do you know me or like anything like that. He was so modest. He was like, so are you a DJ? And I was like, yeah. He's like, you like to scratch? I'm like, yeah, man, I brought my records. I love to scratch. He's like, oh, really? All right. Well, he's like, hey, girl, you mind if I like scratch? And she was like, oh, I thought we were going to watch a movie. And he's like, yeah. And then it began. We went to the back. He had, you know, 8 turntables laid out in an octagon, all facing each other. And he just moved in. It's all fresh. We get on, and it was like magic, man. It was just me and him and his cousin, who didn't really scratch. So, like, we just started cutting. Thank you. we were scratching for hours. We were exchanging ideas. I was showing him my DMC routine. This is before I won, so I had all of that. He was showing me his newest ideas. Then people started coming over. This band came over. We started jamming with them. These other guys came over. We started DJing. I mean, it was like 6 in the morning, and I had to leave to get my flight. We had been awake all night. The guy was so cool. He walked me out, like, as I was getting my cab to leave and rush to the airport. He shook my hand. He's like, "Mike, thank you for coming. I learned so much from you," he said. And I was like, "Dude, you just blew my mind. Like, you're the most humble dude I've ever met. Like, you're incredible. I learned so much from you, and you're saying that." And he's like, "Here's my number. Call me up. Let's chill." Amazing, man. Like, how many pro superstar musicians are going to do that, right? Like, he is truly the godfather of scratch music, and, like, just an ambassador in the way that I've never seen. And, you know, I got to go over again. I called him up, came back, met up with some more amazing scratch musicians, and got to hang out and meet up with him again. And, yeah. Share the fact that I won the DMC, so it's pretty amazing.
That's crazy. They say don't meet your heroes, but I
know
that, that's so wrong in this case.
I'm not making this up. Like, he was really that cool. Like, I know they say don't meet your heroes, but this is one of those cases where not only did it not disappoint, like, he just went above and beyond. But that's, like, everybody says that. Everybody who meets him, like, that's just the way he is. Like, he's a unique individual.
Still mind-blowing. Like, this is a guy who won the DMC so many times, like, they had to retire him. Like, mm-hmm. He really is just the best that's ever done it. And, you know, a true original and master on the turntable. Unbelievable.
He is.
So tell me, you know, after all this, after all these musical experiences that you have, what is on the horizon, or what is still left that you'd like to accomplish, that you'd like to learn, that you'd like to do kind of in the realm of music?
Oh, yeah, so much. It doesn't stop, right? Like, music is an obsession. So, where do I begin? Like, I'm still DJing a bit, and I actually got an invitation today to perform at an event in Florida for work. I got to DJ at an event in San Francisco at the Moscone Center this year, which is pretty rad as well.
I still haven't heard seen the video from that.
I know.
I would like a link to that. If there is video, I really hope you'll send that out to me at some point.
I can ask my man, Mike Esser, to see if there's a video. They weren't able to release it for copyright reasons, because I played copyrighted music, and they don't have a proper license, but... I'll see what I can dig up. I can ask him. But there is a video. It's pretty hilarious. Like, afterwards, I got to play that intro, and it was for a corporate event for my company, and this dude walks out and talks about the performance. It's pretty funny. I can send you that one. But, yeah, so I'm still doing that, and I'm just blown away by, like, technology these days. I got to use, like, the latest Serato, and I was mixing mostly EDM, really techno, like, and house music specifically. And it's so fun. And they just, you know, it makes it so easy because you can automatically beat match. And you spend more time thinking about the blend and less time just getting the technical, you know, BPM right. And while, yes, it makes it easier for DJs, I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it actually allows for a different kind of creativity. Though we have to respect the creators and the people that did not have the same crutches that we have today. Anyhow, Yeah, I'm doing all sorts of stuff, like playing acoustic guitar for my kids, and just getting them into music is really important to me. We got a drum set. You probably don't know that, but we have a drum set. Also, again, I want my kids to get into it, but I've been experimenting with rhythm a lot more. And still recording.
Is Evan learning to play, or like?
Yeah. So Evan and his mom are taking ukulele lessons, and he is very interested in that. He's also interested in dance. So it's like, it's clear he's got rhythm and music in his bones. And, you know, he's 7, so he's just getting started with like fingering of ukulele is pretty hard, but he can strum and he's got rhythm. And drums as well. Like, I just try to let them just jam on it and slam out, but then I'll try to bust a funky beat and show them, hey, look, this is what you can do when you think a little bit more about it. I mean, I still have the, we have the family grand piano. I have that in the basement. I'm looking at it right now, and the microphone, and got a little man cave of studio recording. So just trying to mess around with multi-tracking and basically doing cover songs for my own fun. But, you know, there are a few local musicians and friends of mine that play in bands, and we've got, I guess, opportunities to jam out and whatnot. Not playing out for the public, but just practicing. And then another thing that I've been getting back into is classical piano. So a friend of mine, Eric, is a great classical violinist, and he really turned me on to accompanying violin and going back to the classics, playing stuff like Beethoven and Brahms. So we worked on Beethoven has made 10 famous sonatas for piano and violin, and we worked through that. They go from pretty hard to really hard. So the Kreutzer is the 9th sonata, which I'm obsessed with. It's beautiful and extremely difficult and challenging for both piano and violin. And we can play through the first movement of that. So that would be my next big mountain to climb, to be able to play one of those. Play the Kreutzer would be pretty fucking awesome.
Dude, I'm just forever impressed by all the different, you know, musical avenues that your mind takes and that, you know, you pursue. You're always challenging yourself musically, and that is something that I really respect about you and your approach to music. Yeah,
well,
you're forever
I think
learning
we share
new
that
stuff
in common.
And,
what did you say?
I don't know. I always make music, but I wind up, you know, relying on a lot of the same tricks. You know, I learn new things and I challenge myself, but I think that the way, you know, the way that you push yourself musically in the, you know, the time that you have to devote to it is really impressive and awesome. And I look forward to hearing everything, you know, that you do.
That is super kind. Yeah. Well, music is, you know, it's a personal pleasure, but it's also about performance and sharing that with others. So, I mean, look at you. You're out there performing music with bands and putting your shit out and, you know, getting album after album after album out there. So I really believe like just getting it out there and sharing with others is really important. At least, you know, it's not for everybody. Some people just take enjoyment in the music and strumming a tune on the guitar at home is enough. But there is a part of me that loves performance, and it's about making a human connection with others, you know, like sharing an emotion you have through music. And often I feel like it's easier to do that through music than through words sometimes. So that's like, I think we probably both share that passion, right? Like being able to connect to others through musical sound that we make is just like so fun and rewarding.
Definitely. Well, thank you for sharing your musical experiences and, you know, your journey through music. I know you're not always it's not always easy to put it into words, and you really told the story of it today. So I really appreciate you giving me your time and sharing all that with me and with everybody else. And it's, you know, it's very much on behalf of Northern Virginia and what, you know, being raised in that climate did for us as people and as musicians.
Yes, absolutely. My pleasure. And I agree. I mean, it's no coincidence that where we came from has influenced the way we think about music quite a lot. And I feel like we grew up in a really unique place, confluence of all these different musical backgrounds and international backgrounds that, made us think about it in a different way, in a really, really good way. So thanks, man. This is wild. Musical trip.